I'd like to call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. Our CLA will note the roll. We do have a quorum. Representative Slawick moves approval of the minutes for January 19th, 2005. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes for January 19th, 2005 are adopted. Members, we only have one item on the agenda for today, other than approval of minutes, and that is the issue of 527s and somewhat of an overview of law relating to 527s and maybe some other campaign finance issues. And we have, in particular, two guests with us today who are certainly more expert on these issues than probably anyone else at the table, Professor Wolf Legal, who we have become familiar with in the last few weeks, as well as Professor David Schultz. Professor Flegel is from William Mitchell Law School, Professor Schultz from Hamlin Law School. Jean Olson from the Campaign Finance Board is also with us today. She's not going to give testimony, but she's here if we have questions that she might be able to answer. Yes, Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I share your view, I guess, and everyone else's, that the influence of money on campaigns is often a corrupting thing, and we should try to control it as much as possible. But I'm observing that 527 organizations are governed by federal statute, not state, and so I'm somewhat curious as to know why we're entertaining this subject today.
Fair question, Representative Ellison, and let me explain that to you. But let me just kind of set out some ground rules first. I am anticipating a lot of questions, probably from both sides of the aisle on this issue. So what I would ask is that you ask one question. If you have a relevant follow-up because your question wasn't answered, that's great. But otherwise, then, we'd like to move through our list so that everyone has a chance to ask questions. You can get right back on the list again if you'd like. But if we could try to keep our questions to one at a time, and then we'll move on to the next member. Just a little background as to why I would like to see this, or why I asked for this particular informational hearing. And I will be the first to admit that 527s and laws regarding 527s confuse me terribly. And I think it's probably true of most of us at this table that this is very confusing, as well as most of the people in this room. But I think it's also fair to say that they are here. They certainly had an effect on our last set of elections in Minnesota. Some may say a good effect, some may say a bad effect, but they certainly had an effect. And my thought is, if outside organizations can come in and spend millions of dollars, at least partially under the radar screen, I want to know, as a member of this committee, how and whether we can regulate them. And I think it's a fair question to ask, can we regulate them at the state level, and if so, how? So that is the crux of the question that I would like to see answered today by our testifiers. I don't have a big problem with money in politics. I don't see that as the key problem myself, as long as voters know where it's coming from. And that's where I think I was greatly frustrated by 527s in the last election, that the transparency that we as Minnesotans are used to and are somewhat proud of didn't seem to apply to 527s. And I think that's been true across the United States. Many of you have different concerns, but that's what I would like to see answered today. So fair question, and that's my answer to it. With that, and with that little piece of commentary, I would like to introduce Professor Flegel. And what I have asked the two testifiers to do is, Professor Flegel is going to give us kind of a nuts and bolts of 527 law. If you have questions regarding specifically what he's talking about, we will go ahead and entertain those while he's testifying. But save the bigger picture questions for after Professor Schultz so that we can ask our questions of both of them, if you would. Professor Flegel, if you could introduce yourself to the stage.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members, Chairman Johnson. My name is Will Flegel, and I serve on the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. It was my pleasure, in conjunction with the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association and William Mitchell College of Law, to preside at the Law School for Legislators here within the last week. And I'm pleased to be present again today to answer your questions relative to issues of campaign finance. My plan would be to give a brief overall introduction to acquaint you with what a 527 is, and then to try and provide some context for how Minnesota regulation currently undertakes to control the process of campaign finance-related issues. If at any time you should have a question on some of the fundamental materials, both Professor Schultz and I did provide some background information for you, and I'd be happy to entertain your questions. Fundamentally, Minnesota's approach to the regulation of campaign finance issues is, as I had explained it in a general fashion, in our law school for legislators, we regulate both campaign finance and disclosure requirements. As a state entity, the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board interfaces with 527s in one of two contexts. Either they are an unregistered association, an entity that is not registered with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and in consequence of that, they're limited in the amount and nature of activities that they can undertake in the state under 10A27 Subdivision 13. They may not spend or contribute more than $100 without being subject to violation of state law, unless they file a contemporaneous disclosure form, which, although unregistered, would require them to disclose in the same level of detail information as would an entity that is registered with the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Representative Ellison, that's the context within which the interrelationship between the two entities occurs. If I may, I'm going to now begin with a very brief introduction to what is a 527 and the nature of those activities that have taken place largely on a federal level. A 527 is an organization established for tax purposes under 26 U.S.C. Section 527 of the tax code. In that manner of its organization, has a tax-exempt status from paying federal income taxes on contributions that it may receive. It is, however, taxed at the highest applicable corporate rate on any investment income that it earns. 527s were created in 1974 to provide an exemption from federal income and gift taxes to political organizations, and have been subject to some modest regulation by the federal authorities over the course of time, which evolved most significantly during the passage of the so-called McCain-Feingold bill in 2002. The BCRA, Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. Most recently, in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality and the viability of the undertakings to regulate 527s in a case called McConnell versus the FEC. That upheld significant regulation over 527s, and particularly one avenue. Although it consists of numerous points, 13 of which were addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Fundamentally, 527s in their function look a little like PACs, political action committees, and have similar purposes. But they are not subject to the regulation to the same extent as would be PACs, which are regulated by the federal election laws. In contrast, a 527 that does not engage in election, direct election activity would fall outside the general regulation of the Federal Election Commission. Terms of art that are useful to understand and appreciate, therefore, is what we mean by direct election activity, since it is that as a threshold matter that would determine whether or not an entity must register and be subject to the regulation of the Federal Election Commission. Significantly, the goal of a 527 is to raise money. It's not subject to limitations on from which sources it may take money. It may accept contributions in any amount from any source. It does have certain reporting requirements under the Internal Revenue Service regulations. Once a 527 is created, it must generally register with the Internal Revenue Service and thereafter make regular reports on its funding and expenditures. In that way, there is some disclosure and reporting requirement. It must fundamentally file in the event that it anticipates that it will have gross receipts in contributions to it over $25,000. where a 527 falls subject to regulation and specifically to limitations on its activities under the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act would be in a bar of direct federal election activities. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act prohibits certain types of what it calls electioneering communications. These are communications designed to affect the outcome of an election, which are undertaken in a period of within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. And the BCRA or McCain-Feingold limits the amount or nature of these activities in the event that a 527 does engage in attempts to affect the outcome of a federal election within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. It must then fall subject to FEC reporting requirements. The written materials that I prepared, although they apparently in the email translation did not line up as my original does, reflect the nature of the 15 highest contributors on a national level, 15 top money-raising 527s, and then compares 527s in a general fashion for the so-called presidential 527s and their comparative spending between those that are identified as Democratic or Republican 527s. And then finally, the materials that are set forth on, I believe it's the fourth page of my materials, at the bottom of the fourth page and the top of the fifth page as the document has been printed, reflect the top dozen 527 activities within the state of Minnesota in terms of contribution. Fundamentally, the function of a 527, therefore, works to try and affect outcomes of elections through the collective exercise of speech and association of members to that organization. This raises an interesting intersection between the constitutional mandates of the United States Constitution, declaring that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, and the ability of citizens collectively to pool their resources in groups to amplify their voices on public policy issues as a protected right, and the right of the government to assure the integrity of electoral processes. And that's a balance which most recently in McConnell versus the Federal Elections Commission, our Supreme Court assessed and determined that despite the First Amendment right of free speech, that the federal government was within its province to regulate or make the 527 subject to the regulation expressed in the McCain-Feingold bill. The principal approaches that have been used and are principally used in Minnesota under our campaign finance laws require limitations on contributions and also control the disclosure of how campaign funds are expended. If on the federal system the operation of 527s proceeds within the constraints of existing federal regulation as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court in McConnell versus the FEC, then those 527s which seek to engage in so-called electioneering communication must provide a level of disclosure consistent with that exacted from other organizations that seek more directly to influence election outcomes. So there is regulation that occurs at that level. The danger, if one exists to 527s, is to the extent that they may exist on a smaller level, say they believe in good faith that they may not raise more than $25,000, they may fall off the radar of any entity that is subject to supervise their activities. The larger spending, larger participating units, particularly those that engage in concerted activities, may therefore fall subject to regulation. But the emergence of this entity since 1974 and its proliferation within the last three election cycles of spending more funds and raising more funds obviously indicate that it is an entity to be monitored and its development and impact on our elective process. I'd be glad to answer any general questions at this time. Otherwise, we have asked Professor Schultz to present and to imagine what some of the implications might be for 527s in the future.
Thank you, Professor. Representative Simon, you had a general question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question, and I thought I heard you say at the beginning as a threshold matter that really the only practical way that the state would have jurisdiction over this entire issue of 527s is if a 527 were to make a contribution of more than $100 to a candidate or to a party. So if a group calling itself Americans for Everything Good gave $100.01 to candidate A or party A, then it would come within the sort of ambit of authority of your office or the Campaign Finance Board. But otherwise, am I understanding correctly that there would be no jurisdiction?
Professor Flegel?
Thank you, Chairman Johnson, Representative Simon. There are three ways in which there could be an interface, but I'll agree with you as a general proposition and then be a little more specific, if I may. Our threshold says that anyone, whether they register with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board or not, may participate in the political process. Should, however, they exert more than $100 of influence and they remain unregistered, that would violate the state laws that this body and the Senate have passed, in that unregistered associations may not exert beyond that threshold of influence. They may choose voluntarily to register themselves, irrespective of the measure of their involvement. There's not $100 and you may not register. You can register at any level. Once registered, an entity must report to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board contributions and expenditures. A third level in which it may become involved is that assume that an entity began participating in the process and was unregistered, assuming that it would not exceed that $100 threshold, but it does. At that point, it may voluntarily file with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board the same kinds of forms and disclosures as would be required of a registered entity. And if it does that contemporaneous with expending more than the $100, then it complies with state law. So the interface with our state agency, if there was a 527 and it was unregistered and sought to exert more than $100 of influence, there would be a problem that would have to be dealt with under state law. In the event that there was an entity that was registered, it would have to report, as the legislation dictates all reports must be filed in the state. Or if it was unregistered and realized that its level of activity would now surpass the threshold, it would, in order to comply with law, have to report.
Representative Simon?
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. I think that
That was a long yes.
No, I mean, I understand it a little better now. But I just want to make sure I understand one thing that you just explained, and that is the $100 of influence we're talking about, or that you mentioned, is $100 with respect to a direct contribution, right? So $100 or $1 million or $10 million of electioneering on its own behalf, on an issue-based, sort of issue-based basis, I guess, that's okay. We're only talking about the only time where Minnesota would have jurisdiction is more than $100 in a direct contribution. Is that right?
Professor Flegel.
Thank you. Chairman Johnson, Representative Simon, that is correct. It's $100 of contributions. Expenditures can exist in under the current law in any measure or nature. You can take out an issue ad. You can pursue a get-out-the-vote. In the materials that I provided, we outline the different ways in which the 527s have expended funds, ranging from broadcast, advertising, direct mail, event costs, and so forth. Contributions to candidates is only one aspect, and the $100 that is the current subject of state regulation would be on contributions, direct contributions.
Thank you. Representative Emmer, you had a question?
It's a general one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Flegel, before we move on to further testimony, you had finished your comments by saying that in light of the money that has been raised by these organizations over the last three campaign cycles, the words I wrote down, you said it is an entity that needs to be monitored. Could you please expand on in your position, could you tell us how you would suggest that it be monitored, because my understanding is in your position, what you're concerned with is the transparency and the disclosure, so the general public not only has an opportunity to vote, but they understand where the message is coming from. Is that a fair understanding on my part?
Professor Flegel?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Emmer, among the goals of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board is transparency in the elective process, principally through avenues of disclosure, through the filing of mandatory reports that allow members of the public to know as readily as possible who seeks to influence the outcome by their contributions to individual candidates. When I referenced the particular involvement or increase within the last three election cycles, I'm looking at published reports from the Center of Public Integrity, which indicate that in 2004, 527s raised a total of $434 million, which represents $60 million more than in the years 2001 to 2003 combined. So there has been a significant increase in the level of involvement of those kinds of entities. In terms of their monitoring, my principal role on the Campaign Finance Board is simply to see and assure as far as possible that the laws of the state of Minnesota have been complied with in terms of where there is disclosure required, that disclosure has been made, so that the public may form informed judgments, much in the way that you described.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear, though. Your last statement was these are entities that need to be monitored and supervised, and that includes at a state level. Is that what you were referring to?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Emmer, as part of our charge, yes, to the extent that an entity is an unregistered association as a 527, their level of involvement is limited to the $100 that we discussed, or they must report. If they do not do so, enforcement authority has to be brought to bear, and that's part of the function of the board on which I serve. Yes.
I think now would be a good time to move on. I have one follow-up question myself, but then to move on to Professor Schultz. The $100 limit, does that include any kind of contribution, including in-kind, or just an actual contribution?
The Representative Johnson, that $100 is a direct contribution which can be made in any number of manners. We're principally talking about dollars that are exchanged for a direct contribution. In-kind services would be subject to other regulation.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Chairman,
it is related. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Flegel, to expand on Representative Emmer's question, I'm just curious, with the enabling legislation at the federal level that's created 527s and similar organizations, has the state been preempted from doing anything? Without getting any kind of detail, I'm just wondering philosophically, is there something that the Minnesota legislature can do to sort of preserve what I think is the public policy of transparency and simplicity in our system, or are we sort of relegated to sitting on the sidelines and lobbying Washington?
Professor?
Chairman Johnson, Representative De La Forest, there's a yes and no component to my answer to your question, unfortunately. Certainly with regard to creation and the monitoring of 527s consistent with the Federal Internal Revenue Service guidelines, the state would have no role and would clearly be on the sidelines. But where any entity seeks to exert its influence within our state in a political context, it may fall subject to existing regulations and guidelines that exist under state law, as I was explaining with Representative Simon. Whether that means we're completely without the ability to state a voice, I can't say. I believe that we currently do regulate 527s to the extent that they participate directly through contributions in Minnesota. But clearly, a 527 as an entity is a creature of federal law, federal tax law, and principally its activities in politics, to the extent that they engage in direct election activity or so-called electioneering activity, fall subject to the regulation of the Federal Election Commission. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
Thank you, Professor. We may have follow-ups to that as well, but I think I'd like to move to Professor Schultz's testimony right now. So please proceed.
Great.
And just for the record, my name is David Schultz. I'm a professor at Hamline University, both in the graduate school and in the law school. And as I understood it, that my assignment today was to sort of speculate 18 months into the future. It's kind of like the ghost of Christmas present and Christmas future or something like that. But to speculate 18 months into the future, assuming no changes in state law, assuming no changes in federal law, what might be the impact of 527s upon the state? And I was trying to think of a good way of putting this together, and I thought the best way to do it is to tell a story maybe in the process, and to assume, for the sake of argument, that Boris and Natasha are widget moguls, and that what they want to use is their ample resources to get their way with Minnesota politics in the year 2006. I'm also going to assume, for the sake of argument, that Boris and Natasha are acting legally, because clearly if they're acting illegally, we have a whole bunch of different scenarios. They're acting illegally, but there's no changes in the current law. But at the same time, they want to hide their tracks. They want to, as much as possible, try to hide from the fact that they're involved in politics and trying to leverage their resources in politics. What might Boris and Natasha do? Well, first off, what I want to sort of go back to is make an argument that, in many ways, understanding 527s, we need to make a couple of distinctions. I think it's a question that a couple of the representatives were getting at, is that I think we need to make some distinctions between whether or not Boris and Natasha want to use or want to spend their money to influence state races versus federal races in the state. And this is where I might have a question in terms of, I thought I heard something different that you said, maybe I misunderstood something. But clearly there's two tracks here. Do they want to, in 2006, try to affect the 8 congressional races and the 1 Senate race? I think I got that right. Or do they want to affect the constitutional office races and all the state legislative races? And depending on whether or not Boris and Natasha want to spend money and set up a 527 to affect federal versus state races, I think there are different avenues in terms of what they can do. And I think there's also different opportunities for the state to step in terms of regulatory activity. But let's sort of start with the state first and just sort of outline a couple of things. At the state level, in many ways, I think that 527s fit in within a pattern regarding how many groups can already spend money in politics in Minnesota to affect state races. And again, when I say state races, I mean non-federal races, just to clarify. Already groups or individuals can make hard money contributions. They can make contributions which are often called soft money contributions to political parties, caucuses, to other entities. They can hire a lobbyist, which is not quite making a contribution of an election, but that's a way of leveraging influence. And they can also engage in spending through independent expenditures. Where 527s, I think, fit into the fabric under the state organization, or within our state laws, is that if Boris and Natasha wish to spend, set up a 527 to affect state races, they, of course, first have to establish the 527 through the IRS tax code, which, again, I think Professor Fiegel is absolutely correct in terms of saying the establishment of the 527s in terms of how that occurs is beyond our control. I mean, that's fairly preemptive. But once they have done that, at the point where 527s now wish to affect state races, my understanding of the law, and I may be wrong on this one, is that if Boris and Natasha try to set up perhaps maybe the Frostbite Falls Fund or something like that, or Citizens for Everything Good and True or something like that, if they want to set up a political entity within the state to affect state races, they're still going to have to register within the state of Minnesota. And if they're going to do that, they're going to have to comply in terms of all the registration requirements and all the disclosure requirements that presently exist under Minnesota state law. And so that if those entities are operating to affect state races, they must do that. However, where Boris and Natasha can be very creative in terms of what they can do is they can do what a lot of other groups already do within Minnesota law. They can make, for example, they can set up their Frostbite Falls Fund. They can get their friends Rocky, Bullwinkle, Sherman, and Peabody to set up their own 527s, make contributions to the local party units. Those local party units then could make contributions to the state parties. Or they could do things involving variations of independent expenditures, either as groups in them themselves, or they could eventually filter money over into local parties or eventually transfer it up to the state party units or to the caucuses that in turn could make independent expenditures. The point that I'm getting at, and I said this in kind of a confusing way on purpose, the way I just laid it out, is that one of the things that I think 527s can do at the state level is something very similar to what I think a lot of groups can already do in the state, is that you have lots of avenues regarding how you can expend money to try to leverage influence. And if you are committed to trying to hide your tracks, while it's not totally possible to do it. You can make it more difficult to hide your tracks by either giving money at different levels, giving it again to local party units, giving it to the state party, giving it to the caucuses, and then those groups can in turn transfer that money to other entities in the state. And so that while somewhere along the line, your name, Rocky Bullwinkle, Frostbite Falls Fund, might occur somewhere in there, that becomes one of the patterns that I think 527s could do. And so that one of the things that I would do and would anticipate down the line, the next 18 months, is that you might see at the state level more of a proliferation of 527s, which operate essentially, as I would say, as kind of like conduit funds or as sort of, banks or something like that. I'm not sure what I want to call it, where they could be funds into which individuals and entities give money. Those groups then and then they adopt pretty innocuous sounding names. And then in turn, maybe either transfer that money to other entities or funnel it through existing parties or other entities within the state. And thus that process of tracking becomes more difficult because it's kind of like going money goes from A to B to C to D to E, et cetera, like that. And so I think that's one problem, but that's a problem that I think that already exists within the Minnesota system, the ability to sort of make that kind of a movement. Now, in terms of federal law, I think it becomes a little bit more complex. And this is where I might defer to Professor Flegel on something. If Rocky Bullwinkle, Fearless Leader, Natasha, et cetera, want to try to affect the 8 congressional races and the 1 senatorial race, again, they would set up a 527 organization. And at that point, this is where I'm a little unclear. I wasn't sure, but maybe the law does require it, the state law does require it. I'm not sure if in every circumstance they're required, if they're only going to affect federal races, if they're required to register under Minnesota law. They're not. And that's what I thought. I just wanted to be sure on that. So that if they wanted to affect the Dayton, whomever race, assuming Dayton's running, or any of the 8 congressional members, they could establish a national 527, call themselves, again, the Frostbite Fall Fund, Citizens for a Better Environment, whatever they may want to do. They then have the capacity to raise money nationally. In relative, well, they can actually, except in one circumstance, they can raise unlimited amounts of money, and then they can expend that money for a variety of purposes to try to affect the races within Minnesota. The major distinction that would occur is that the 527s, 30 or 60 days out of a primary or a general election, that is beyond 30 or 60 days, could engage in some types of activities that look like electioneering communications. They could expend money for some television ads. They could engage in a lot of sort of very traditional activity that, again, looks like what PACs used to do. What becomes more interesting is what the 527s can do within 30 or 60 days. And within 30 or 60 days, they, of course, would also fall under the federal law that says that if they engage in electioneering communication, if they in any of their advertisements refer to an identifiable federal candidate, for example, maybe they show a picture of Betty McCollum, assuming she's running for re-election, then the presumption would be that if they are running those ads, the money that is used to pay for those ads would have to conform with what would be called the federal hard money requirements. So they couldn't have Fearless Leader give them $1 million to run those kind of ads. On the other hand, what becomes more interesting and harder to track is that what if within 30 or 60 days of a primary or general election, the 527s decide not to run television ads. This is where it becomes even harder to track them. Because at that point, federal law says that electioneering communication only refers to broadcast type of activity. And they've got a definition of broadcasting. I think it's, what, the 50,000 people or something like that or more. What if they decide to do a variety of activities, low-level broadcasting to only a couple of thousand people? What if they decide not to do broadcasting at all and engage in what would be more traditional grassroots activity, door knocking, maybe some get-out-the-vote activities, et cetera, et cetera? A lot of that stuff falls below the radar. All that stuff could be financed with unlimited contributions. And so I mention that because where I think it becomes even more difficult to track 527 under federal law when they're trying to influence federal elections is that if they decide not to directly do the most visible type of activity, you know, the television ads, the radio ads, if they go down to, again, the grassroots activity, the door-to-door stuff, as they did in this past election in 2004, then it becomes much more difficult to track them. Coupled with that, that if under federal law, or if as a 527 they're only trying to affect federal elections, there is a limited disclosure in terms of when they disclose and how they disclose. And so that also makes it more difficult in terms of keeping track of them. Okay. Where does all this put us then? Well, if Boris and Natasha do have those ample resources, and if they decide they want to hide their activity and they want to set up 527s at both the state and federal level, we probably have, for federal races, we probably have almost nothing. I don't want to say nothing, but it may be almost nothing that we can do in terms of regulating their behavior. However, if they decide to set up a 527 to try to affect state races, that's where we're not preempted in terms of a variety of options. One of those options could be, for example, that we change disclosure laws within the state of Minnesota. There's nothing that would preclude, for example, the state of Minnesota from requiring Boris, Natasha, Fearless Leader, Sherman, and Peabody from having to do, for example, some type of, I'll come up with something, some type of 24-hour rule for disclosure. That within 24 hours of making an expenditure over a certain amount, $500, $1,000, whatever it may be, that they would have to file maybe with campaign practices electronically some kind of disclosure to indicate that they've done that. Maybe we could also set up a requirement for more pre-election reporting, which would also be an option that the legislature could consider, so that we could have a combination of, again, relatively instantaneous disclosure upon contribution or expenditure, and we could also say that, I don't know, I'll make up something, 7 days before election, or 5 days, or 2 days before an election, that's the last report that has to be filed by an entity. So those become some of the things that we could do. In turn, we could also, for organizations that are trying to make contributions, 527s, if they want to be able to take money in from individuals and then make a contribution to another entity, we could, under McConnell, FEC versus McConnell, we could impose some limitations upon entities in terms of their ability to make what would be called soft money contributions to the caucuses, to the parties, or to other entities in the state. And so that, again, I underscore and say that within state law for 527 seeking to try to influence state races, we do have a variety of options that we could exercise.
Thank you, Professor, and we do have some questions, but first I want to introduce a group from Leadership Duluth, which is an organization within the Duluth Area Chamber of Commerce, and they are participating in the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People Tour and educational program, so welcome. We're glad to have you today. You probably figured out already we're talking about 527 fundraising organizations and whether we at the state level can do anything to regulate them, so welcome. Representative Broad, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schultz, Professor Schultz, wow, that was quite a roundabout with Boris and Natasha. My question with Boris and Natasha is they seem to be engaged in a lot of hiding, of trying to make sure that nothing is seen and not seen. And you talk about conduits and using banks, for example, I think was one of your examples for conduits of funds. Generally, one bank knows in advance what's going to happen on the next at the end of the money at the next bank and so on and so on. So there seems to be it's known what's going to happen to the money from where it starts to where it ends. It doesn't seem that that's the case with these 527s on the surface. Because we can't know. You can't earmark. You can't direct funds. So my question is, it doesn't seem like a great correlation between a known and an unknown with these 527. There's a lot of unknowns out there on where the money goes, where it ends up. And it seems like the transparency part that we all need to be looking at is absolutely washed away. So how do you see in your 18-month future with Boris and Natasha transparency improving or not improving with these 527s increasing?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, a couple of things first, just to clarify, so lest nobody thinks I'm picking on banks. When I referred to banks, I was sort of just referring to organizations transferring money, so I don't want anybody to think I'm, again, picking on banks per se. I don't see the transparency improving in the next 18 months, subject to, for state races, Subject to a couple of clarifications on that. First, I mean, all of us know about the recent decision by campaign practices regarding the 21st Century Democrats. And the 21st Century Democrats as a national entity did not, from my understanding, did not register with the state in terms of complying with state registration laws. Now, assuming for the sake of argument that entities do comply with state law, that they do register, then you do have a degree of transparency that is there. But the 527s that are trying to affect state races would have to comply with the same disclosure laws that are there for any other entity in the state of Minnesota. If, of course, they decide not to comply with the law, that's a big issue, of course. You know, that is partly a legislative issue, but the law enforcement issue also. But at the federal level, so I'm going to jump back and forth, but at the state level, short of any kind of breakdown in registration by 527 groups, the disclosure for those groups will only be as good as the disclosure laws are in the state for any other entity in the state of Minnesota. At the federal level, on the other hand, I don't see any change in the disclosure process. And the problem that you also have at the federal level, without going into a really completely different discussion, is that there was an opportunity by the Federal Election Commission last May, I think it was May 11th, which would have amended FEC rules to require more registration by the 527s with the Federal Election Commission, not just with the IRS, and it would have imposed a variety of new tests upon 527s to ensure that they would have to comply with and register with the FEC. Unfortunately, last May, the FEC deadlocked, I think, 3-3 in terms of amending the rules. And so, short of, I think, of either changes in personnel at the FEC or changes in federal legislation, I don't see anything occurring at that level. So I don't see any changes at the 527 for the federal.
Representative Broad.
Thank you. I just have a quick follow-up. One is, I want to go a little bit further. Do you see earmarking happening? In your opinion, quite often. And the second comment, when you talked about our changes in disclosure, what we could do here in Minnesota, you talked about we could talk about disclosures if somebody makes an expenditure. How about if somebody makes an expenditure in another state that influences or impacts an election in ours?
Professor Schultz.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, a couple of points here. One is in terms of earmarking. The notion of earmarking or coordination, I think, is kind of interesting because in some situations, and when I think in terms of the way our present state law is written about earmarking, there's almost a clear intentionality aspect to the law, at least is how I read it, that you have to sort of clearly and intentionally sort of give it to another entity with the purpose of saying, I want you to spend money, this money in XYZ way. It's almost kind of like leaving the smoking gun, writing the letter out, et cetera, et cetera. You don't always have to do that to be able to effectively achieve earmarking or coordination. I mean, we know, for example, at the federal level, for example, that many individuals who served on a 527 also served on other types of entities. Maybe they were parties, maybe they were other organizations. And so effectively, you don't have to always have that explicit sort of statement, please give the money to do X, Y, Z. Second, in terms of, and I hope I answered your question in terms of that. Second, in terms of indirectly affecting an election, one, if any entity is spending money that would directly affect state races, short of a federal preemption issue. You know, and again, the federal preemption issue, I think, becomes a problem. But if an entity is affecting our state races in some way, there's no reason why they can't come within the gamut of the regulatory authority of the state to require disclosure, whatever it may be. Moreover, there's nothing that says that we can't also amend state law to require, again, to the extent that they affect state races, nothing precludes us from amending our law to say, for example, any expenditure that directly or indirectly tries to do X, Y, and Z. We also, in some ways, and I was trying to think about this, and I'm not an expert on securities law, and so if somebody of you are, I defer to that. I know, for example, under federal securities law, there's a requirement that the banks have to disclose names of individuals who make transactions in banks of $10,000 or more. There's also some laws that's in place that say that if individuals try to structure their deposits or their withdrawals from banks in a way to try to avoid that complying with disclosure. They make a whole bunch of $2,000 ones instead. They can also fall under the gambit of federal law if you can show that they intentionally are trying to evade complying with disclosure. There may be ways, and again, don't quote me on the federal securities law. I'm just using an analogy. There may be ways also to craft state law in a way that says that contributions or expenditures that indirectly affect blah blah blah, and then you could have another clause that says individuals who willfully or knowingly seek to try to expend money or make contributions to try to otherwise avoid complying with state disclosure laws may be subject to certain requirements. And so that's a possibility too.
I have a question for you. I was looking at the contribution list from the Center for Public Integrity. It lists the largest contributors to 527s, and I noticed there's a couple of individuals, but it's almost all corporations, unions and corporations. Obviously, corporations cannot give to a state candidate in Minnesota, or I don't believe they can even engage in an independent expenditure on behalf of the candidate. Can a corporation give to a 527, and then that 527 can legally independently expend on behalf of a state candidate? And this is to either of you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Professor Schultz.
Yeah, clearly we know under federal law, I'm going to work towards, I think, getting an answer, and if you can help me on this, I'll be appreciated. We know clearly under the Tillman Act, federal law, dating back almost, I think it's 100 years now, corporations cannot expend money directly to affect or influence federal elections. We also know that labor unions cannot directly expend money to try to affect or influence federal elections. In terms of what McCain-Feingold was meant to try to do, McCain-Feingold was meant to try to close some loopholes in the law that made it possible for corporations and for labor unions to be able to give money to political parties at the federal level, for example, for certain types of activities such as get-out-the-vote activity, voter registration activity, and so forth. And I mention that on McCain-Feingold because where I think there is an open question at this point on 527s, gets back to the comment that I think I had with Representative Broad, that had the Federal Election Commission last May actually voted to amend their own rules, administrative rules, regarding what when a 527 has to report to the Federal Election Commission, at that point it would have been clear, absolutely clear, regarding what the May 11th efforts were trying to do was to basically require 527 to comply with McCain-Feingold. Had those rules gone into place, I could have given you an unequivocal answer and said that corporations and labor unions could not give to 527s if they were directly trying to influence federal elections. However, because those rules were not amended, it's somewhat unclear up to 30 or 60 days before a federal election. It's somewhat unclear regarding what they can actually do at this point. But I would say at this point, sort of the received wisdom is they can clearly do some indirect activities and get very close to things that look like very direct political activity through the 527s. And my answer, I wish I could be clearer on this, but this is sort of, I think, an open question in the law. And again, if Professor Fliegel could sort of maybe add anything to this, I'd appreciate it.
Chairman Johnson, very clearly a corporate entity would fall afoul of our state laws and federal laws as well if they made a direct contribution to a campaign. But the problem is that 527s may take contributions from anyone, and then the issue is what they choose to do with it. If they fall or run up against other regulations, their conduct can be constrained. If they're engaged in conduct within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election, they fall subject to FEC regulation. I think the concern that Professor Schultz voices is a realistic one, and that is outside of those parameters, a 527 may be accountable or sufficiently able to secrete his activities so that it's not subject to regulation by anyone.
So, and I'm much more interested at the state level because there's not much we can do at the federal level. So a 527 that takes corporate money, for example, at least right now probably could engage in activities on behalf of a state Senate candidate, for example, in 06. Is that what you're saying?
Chairman Johnson, a 527 can expend funds for activities that don't involve it in electioneering activity. the state regulatory scheme would constrain certain kinds of its conduct. If the value of a direct contribution can't exceed $100, if it makes a facially excessive contribution, it may fall subject to regulation there. We do have ways to catch or limit its activities, particularly within the time frame that would be sensitive to an election, either a primary or a general election. I think Professor Schultz's concern was if you go back in time or you diminish the level of activity so that it falls below a reporting limit, that may allow the 527 to engage in other unregulated kinds of activities.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
I think the question you're also getting at, too, is if, I don't know, Bullwinkle Corporation or whatever Widget Corporation wants to use a 527 to try to set up a 527, make an expenditure or give a contribution to that, and have the 527 then try to make a expenditure on behalf of a state campaign. Clearly, I think at that point, unless I'm mistaken, I think there would be real problems under state law for a corporation being able to do that in terms of affecting a state race. I think that would be illegal.
Violate 211B11.
Because I think 211B11 is direct and says it's direct and indirect, if I remember correctly, the language.
Correct. Okay. Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor, I want to follow up on what Representative Broad was talking to you about in your testimony. Do I understand correctly, based on your answers to her question and your testimony, that you have some concerns with the way the law is drafted right now, what it's allowing? And if I might be more specific, my understanding is the McCain-Feingold campaign reform, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, was intended to resolve corruption and the appearance of corruption in terms of campaign financing. And specifically with regards to soft money, which I think is what this conversation just was with Chairman Johnson, how all this additional money that can't be tracked got pumped into the national parties, and they tried to restrict that with this reform. Do I understand correctly from your testimony that, in fact, now the problem is not within the national parties? The reform has actually shifted the problem to 527s, and that you would suggest, in order to try and control this problem at a state level or a local level, that we have some type of legislation that deals with pre-election reporting or some more stringent requirements in regards to disclosure, so we know who it is, in fact, whether it's an entity or an individual or a group of individuals that's trying to influence our local races. Do I understand you correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I think in part, yes, you do have it correct. I think I have sort of two concerns. One of them clearly, again, going back to what McCain-Feingold was trying to do, McCain-Feingold was trying to clearly address the soft money problem predominantly as it affects federal races and in terms of it affects national political parties, and secondarily to try to keep state political parties out from being sort of a backdoor way of trying to affect federal races. For example, what McCain-Feingold tried to prevent was a diverting of money to state parties or state caucuses who would then in turn run maybe the issue ads or the attack ads, if we want to use those, to try to affect the federal races. What I think we need to do on the state level, if I can sort of interject, is I think we need to do a couple of things. You know, one of them is that while clearly I think we're all bothered by the transparency issue, I think also another issue which we should all worry about is whether or not individuals or entities should be able to make, you know, unlimited expenditures to try to be able to affect state races. I think I'm equally concerned about a wealthy individual or any organization being able to use their war chest for those purposes. So I would actually advocate a couple of different reforms. One of them is clearly on the disclosure aspect in terms of having more frequent disclosure, especially more frequent pre-election disclosure, because I think post-election disclosure, while it's nice, it doesn't help people in terms of being able to understand what's happening in the election. I think that if people are making their decision, and I think it's useful information to know whether or not an entity is giving some candidate or some organization money or just finding out who's spending money. if for no other purpose than the principle of democracy. We should know who's affecting our races. But second, we should also know who's giving money is also a clue oftentimes of who spends who takes what position. But second, I also personally believe that we need some variation of a state version of a McCain-Feingold law, which would try to, again, deal with some of the impact of soft money on state politics. For the last 10 years, I've been sort of gathering the information from campaign practices and recrunching the numbers. And one of the things that we can clearly show is how what we call soft money contributions far outstrips the amount of hard money in the state of Minnesota. I mean, part of the argument that I've given in the past is that if we actually add up all the numbers, about 10% of all the money that's expended on state races in Minnesota is subject to either contribution limits or subject to what I think are fairly good disclosure requirements. The other 90% of the money in terms of soft money, lobbyist expenditures, are far less regulated, and we clearly need to get better tabs on it. And the law will allow us, clearly in terms of contributions to parties, caucuses, clearly will allow us to take more direct action. And in cases where we can't take direct action by independent groups in terms of barring independent expenditures, we can certainly require more disclosure than we presently have. And so I would say much more pre-election disclosure would be helpful and good for our political system.
One follow-up?
Representative Ammer?
So included then within or the reforms that you suggest, are they also intended to deal with, and I think you just said this, but entities or individuals that are attempting to circumvent our present campaign finance laws, and I think you referred to the contribution limits, for instance. Is that what you're referring to? Disclosure like that would allow us, for instance, you used the example of a corporation earlier, in effect circumventing the rules by giving money to one of these 527 organizations. I take it that could be an individual doing the same thing, circumventing the rules by giving a significant donation to a 527 organization, which then is applied to local races. We wouldn't know. The Campaign Finance Board wouldn't be able to evaluate those in light of the contribution limits. Is that kind of where you're going?
Representative Emmer, in part, clearly corporations as well as wealthy individuals as well as other entities could, in certain circumstances, raise lots of money to be able to try to affect races. And so, yes, wealthy individuals, may be able to also raise, and in fact do, be able to make contributions to try to affect state races. Where I think I was headed at, and I'm, is that under possible reforms for Minnesota to undertake, we could require a variety of things. One of them, we could, for example, if I were sort of writing my own law in terms of McCain, like a state version of McCain-Feingold law, we could put caps, for example, on how much money individuals contribute to, for example, the parties and caucuses. We could also impose, in some situations, I think, limits on how much money is given to other political organizations in the state by individuals. Federal law, I think, has a parallel to that in terms of what they used to have for PACs. So we could clearly place some caps on, to use your example, on wealthy individuals doing that. In turn, we could also, in some situations, have more disclosure. For example, we clearly can't prevent the First Amendment, and the U.S. Supreme Court won't let us, for example, at this point, place any limits on independent expenditures made by individuals and by entities. If they want to make large contributions for independent expenditures, subject to some of the restrictions outlined in the McConnell opinion, they can do that. However, we could, if they're trying to affect state races, we could come back with a variety of disclosure laws. Many, many years ago, and I'm trying to think of the name of the case now, Deb McKnight might remember one, the Eighth Circuit opinion that invalidated our independent expenditure law. I can't remember the name of the decision off the top of my head. But the reason why I mention that is we used to have a law in the books that had some fairly good regulations in terms of independent expenditures. Eighth Circuit invalidated that, but about 3 years ago, the First Circuit Court of Appeals upheld similar types of restrictions that were they're very parallel to what we used to have in the state. And I think we could, in some ways, go back to some of those restrictions that we used to have in place in Minnesota regarding notification within 24 hours of making an independent expenditure. That would be one way of trying to get a little bit better grip on some of the transparency problems.
I have Representatives Nelson, Broad, De La Forest, Lesch, Hilty, and Slawick on the list. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Fergal, thanks for you and your colleagues for your law school for legislators. That was much appreciated. And either one of you gentlemen, hypothetical. Boris decides to run for the Minnesota Senate. Can Boris, as a candidate, or Natasha, his wife or girlfriend, set up a 527 the way things are written now, receive unlimited amounts of money and spend on Boris's candidacy as independent expenditures?
Who wants to field that one?
You're first.
Okay.
Well, it was his subject. So.
Boris and Natasha get around. Chairman, Representative, I want to first say yes, I think they can do that under certain circumstances. And assuming for the sake of argument they're not doing direct coordination, that Boris is running for the Senate, assuming I would think that Boris is not also sitting on that 527 in terms of an officer or involved in it. If this is truly an independent entity, as 527, they could take unlimited amounts of money, not from corporations, because at that point they're trying, if they're going to try to directly affect the race, but assuming they're trying to directly affect the outcome of that Senate race, I think under state law they could probably take unlimited amounts of contributions, as long as it's not coordinated. But I'm going to defer to Professor Flegel on this one also.
Professor Flegel. Chairman Johnson, Representative Nelson, the way Minnesota defines an independent expenditure, it would be very difficult for it to qualify as a lawful independent expenditure. Boris probably can't make an expenditure for himself to benefit himself that would be independent. To be deemed an independent expenditure, disclosure must be filed indicating that the candidate or committee has had no role to play in the expenditure of the funds. So if Boris is on both entities, it would be very difficult to conceive of a circumstance in which it could be an independent expenditure. One other thing that occurs to me that also might be a fruitful discussion of the hypothetical that you raise is that to the extent that 527 could be organized as a corporation, that corporation could fall subject to Minnesota regulations as well in terms of the purview of 211B, which is outside the scope of campaign finance board, but falls subject to regulation by the Secretary of State.
If I could do one follow-up on that.
Sure.
I think the one exception, I think, on the corporations, though, would be if the corporation was formed for ideological and not-for-profit reasons.
A 501C.
Exactly. Yeah. If it's a 501C, then I think there'd be a different regulatory mechanism that would come into place, because we can clearly under a U.S. Supreme Court decision, something versus Velotti, the Velotti opinion. I think it was within the Velotti one about ideological Massachusetts Citizens Concerned for Life. Is that the one I'm thinking of? You're looking at me. Okay. There is a situation where if you decide to form a corporate entity, but you're simply for the purposes of using the corporate structure, but you're not a for-profit corporate entity, but an ideological one, that situation, you would, I think, even under Minnesota law, it might be the only circumstance where a corporation might be able to make some type of expenditures. But that's a very, very narrow exception. And the 501c3, our 501c entities are in some cases another exception.
Representative Nelson, did you have a follow-up?
Just a little bit further for the other half of it then. How about Natasha, either his spouse or his girlfriend? How much disconnect does there need to be between the candidate and this 527?
Professor Flegel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. To be an independent expenditure, there would have to be independence from the candidate. If Natasha is the treasurer or plays some other functionary role within the confines of the candidacy of her spouse, I doubt that it could be an independent expenditure. One avenue, and this can get into levels of complexity that we might only imagine, but currently Minnesota law defines associations in a manner that would permit an association of one. So it's conceivable that you could get small enough to a single person that a spouse might not be involved. At present, state law does not define what constitutes an immediate family, a member. I can't speak in my role as a member of the campaign finance board to address it. It would just be my personal opinion, but I would assume that we would view a spouse as an immediate family member without a whole lot of difficulty. It's where it becomes Cousin Bob and Uncle Joe that the line becomes more difficult to understand and appreciate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, under federal law, at least under federal administrative rules for the Federal Election Commission, just to sort of use an analogy, the FEC has several presumptions that they have in place that they've codified into the rules that they will use for determining whether or not an entity is independent. And I think probably one of the things that if you're looking for some avenues where we might want to explore in the future, it might not be a bad idea to have either the legislature or, and I'm not sure if the rulemaking authority is broad enough for campaign practices to do this, to also, you know, think about what would be the presumptions so that you'd be able to deal with situations such as Natasha, Natasha's friend, et cetera, or who can serve on different committees. I mean, we found out something very interesting during the last presidential race, for example, that you could be a lawyer advising two different entities or advising a party and advising a 527, and that would not be considered coordination. Whereas, on the other hand, if you were a non-lawyer member of both the party, an officer and an officer in the 527, that would be considered coordination. And that struck lots of us as kind of odd because lawyers oftentimes have, you know, a very influential role in determining how entities are going to be run. And so one direction for the state would clearly be to think in terms of what might be possible avenues to define presumptions in the law.
Can I just ask one more follow-up? Professor Flegel, you were talking about the fact that they were spouses and that might affect the answer to the question about coordination, but let's just say that Boris and Natasha don't really know each other all that well, and she has the 527 and he's running. But they sometimes talk about what would be helpful. Is that enough to make it not an independent expenditure?
Chairman Johnson, it's a problematic hypothetical, but we have, as a board, obviously exercised our authority where it kind of meets the walks like a duck approach to common sense. An independent expenditure is one that the statutory scheme defines as independent. Where there is coordination, you're going to fall subject to difficulties. You may reflect back on the issue with Governor Pawlenty during his recent campaign.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm tired of Boris and Natasha, so let's move on to the Internal Revenue Service. I just have a couple questions in regards to the tax consequence of making a donation to a 527 versus making a donation to another political party or a political unit. Let's take a $100,000 donation. What would the differences, if any, be from a tax perspective?
No. Professor Schultz?
I'm just thinking through the question. Just give me a second. Chairman, Representative Broad, just want to clarify because I'm thinking through this in my mind. So you have $100,000. You could have given it to a 527 versus you could have given it to, I don't know, a political party or a traditionally established PAC?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Partly why I'm sort of thinking about it, it also gets back again to the question, well, in terms of tax implications, I mean, part of the whole purpose of setting up the 527s back in 1974 was to try to avoid the gift tax issue. In terms of making $100,000, we're just talking about tax issues right now. In terms of that $100,000, if you, as far as I know, if you give $100,000 to any political entity, clearly that's not a tax-deductible contribution. Furthermore, if you give $100,000, I also don't believe it's subject to the gift tax, but I'm going to defer to somebody who might know more on sort of, you know, gift tax law than I do. But I don't believe also that any contributions to any 527s or political parties or units would come under any of the gift tax laws. Clearly, they don't come under for 527 purposes. The only situation where you have, I think, tax implications in terms of might they be tax-deductible contributions is in the situation, which we also learned about in the last election, where in some situations 501c3 entities, that is not-for-profit entities, are in some cases able to, under federal tax law, engage in some type of activity that comes up to the point of getting, but not doesn't cross the line into partisan political activity. And there was a whole host of 501c3s. Because 501c3s can do some lobbying, and there's some limits on how much they can do for lobbying, but clearly there were some concerns regarding what those entities could do, and theoretically you could have 501c3s set up, and maybe they would do political commercials that talk about the importance of a whole bunch of issues that just might be very similar to the types of issues that some candidate prefers. Have they crossed the line? No, they haven't, even under federal law. And so you might have some situations for what we call nonprofit entities get very close also to part political activity. I'm not sure if I answered your question, because you were getting more into a tax question.
I just I'll appreciate the answer and maybe get another answer at another time, but I just have one quick follow-up in regards to that same scenario. And maybe Professor Flegel, you'd be able to better answer this for me than from what my understanding currently is. If I were that same donor giving $100,000 to a 527 versus that same or other organization, a political party or a political unit, when would the voters know? Is there differences on when the voters would know between those two different entities?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Broad, in the event that a substantial contribution was given to a political party in Minnesota, we have periodic reporting requirements at the, that would catch that for the Campaign Finance Public Disclosure Board if it was one of the entities that reports to us, a major political party, for example. 527, that's another issue, obviously. If it was a substantial contribution, $100,000 is obviously in excess of the $25,000 threshold, and would, if made within certain time parameters around election activities, could require the 527 to report at least some fundamental data to the Federal Election Commission, to the extent that it was a federal focus of the activities of that 527. But to the extent that contributions are received by a entity registered with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, those are to be reported periodically, and significant contributions have to be recognized within a certain time frame. Our board does post to our internet when contributions are received, to the extent that we have the resources to do that. But at least as relates to candidates, where it's a candidate, we typically don't report contributions to one side unless we can also report contributions to the other to maintain a parity there. Have I answered your question?
Representative De La Forest?
Have I answered your question?
Representative De La Forest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as I have the mic, I'll take an opportunity to once again criticize Washington for failing to help anybody out here. It seems to me the hallmarks of any proper campaign finance regulatory scheme have as a hallmark transparency and simplicity, and we have none of that. Furthermore, we talk about attempting to get the influence of big money out of politics, and when I look at the donors to 527s, they're not my neighbors, certainly. But my question is twofold for both. First of all, look back a little bit to November, and 527 activity obviously was well publicized, but also I think there's a sense out there, which both of you alluded to, that there may have been 527 activity that illegal that flew under the radar that we didn't know about. And I'm just wondering what your sense is. Was there a lot of it? Was there a little bit of it? how big is this problem? Which leads me to my second question as a member of the House Elections Committee. How concerned do we need to be about 527s coming up in the 06 election cycle? Even, I suppose, an argument could be made that we've had soft money and independent expenditures and the like for many, many, many years. But it seems to me the sense I have, sort of a foreboding, which is either Democrat or Republican, that these 527s threaten to proliferate and grow in such a way that it absolutely overwhelms Minnesota's campaign finance scheme and the public policy that underpins it. You know, it's pretty sobering when you look at the fact that all of us, I think with the exception of one member, we agreed in the last cycle to only spend a little bit over $28,000. And you're faced with this prospect that a 527 could roll into your district and spend 2, 5, 10 times that amount, which obviously should be disconcerting to anybody who's interested in fair play and good government.
Professor Slagle.
Pardon? Representative Johnson, Representative De La Forest. He asked a number of questions. The first one, I guess, fundamentally that I'll address is the prospect for activity of 527s that occurs below the radar. I think that is a realistic prospect. There are reporting thresholds and requirements, levels of activities below which 527s may have to account for or to relatively no one. Since a 527 need not be organized in any particular organizational scheme, it could be an association, it can be a corporation, it may have to file no papers. If it determines that its likely gross expenditures will be below $25,000, it need not register with the FEC. If its activities are not to make direct contributions in our state, but rather to engage in expenditures, it may fall outside the regulation of the Campaign Finance Board scheme, which focuses on contributions that are made. So can 527s play a role in Minnesota elections? Yes. Indeed, they can. As to the second question as to the extent to which that has occurred and is occurring, the numbers that I summarized earlier for you are with those much larger national scope 527s. I have no real information to share with you about the level of activity that occurs outside those major 15 that I acquired the data on for you. I could only offer you speculation as to what the role will be in 2006, but I think it's well to be aware that this is occurring as this body considers how to maintain the goals of transparency and permit.
If I can also follow up, Mr. Chair, from Representative. I mean, 2004 was an unusual year in many ways, but it also forebodes for the future. Unusual in the sense that it was the first presidential election cycle, in fact, the first federal election cycle in which McCain-Feingold kicked into place. McCain-Feingold had the impact of shifting money around in our at the federal political system. There's that old adage, of course, that money in politics is like the water balloon. You squeeze in one place and it goes somewhere else. So this is the first time that, to a really significant extent, even far more than 2000, that 527s were exploited because they're the weakest link in the disclosure framework for regulation. And so that, do I see at the federal level, in terms of 527s growing in importance in 2006, there's no question about it. That's still the weakest link in terms of the regulatory framework. In terms of at the state level, and so I think it's just, yes, and I think for reasons Professor Flegel mentioned also, that in terms of the fact that if groups want to stay under the $25,000 threshold, that poses even more problems at the federal level. At the state level, assuming groups want to comply with the state law, that's a big caveat. Assuming when they want to comply, those groups will still have to register if they make the if they're involved in more than $100 contribution levels. Even though they're still going to have to register, as I mentioned before in my testimony, I think groups or individuals might still have a variety of incentives of wanting to use 527s or create lots of small little entities just if they want to confuse people, if they want to hide their tracks. And so, again, the long-winded answer is they're only going to grow in importance at the state and federal level because that's the weakest framework. The 527s are the weakest link of our regulatory framework.
Mr. Chair, I can offer some additional information to Representative De La Forest, at least in one respect. In the year 2000, there were 531 active 527s. For 2004, the number is 2,169. So you can see the proliferation that has occurred in that regard.
As I said, Mr. Chairman, it's pretty sobering to think that there could be a 527 out there that can just about match what you're able to spend, and they don't even have to report, period. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, thanks to Professor Flugel and Schultz. I have to say, Professor Schultz, I was tracking your frostbite balls example pretty well until you suggested that Boris, Natasha, and Bullwinkle and Rocky were all in this together. And then it threw me off, but maybe that's just me.
All right. No, it's hard to keep track of all those
things. It really is. I never saw an episode like that. I have two questions.
Sure.
First is, can either of you give an example of a 527 that stayed outside of the 30 or 60 day rule in the most recent election and that was clearly still in the game for political activity?
Professor...
Not me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, there were, I'm probably going to get the wrong name, but maybe you have it here. Was it ACT, I think it was? One of the groups at the national level, I think, was it the ACT? I was going to say ACT UP, but I'm confusing it with somebody else. There was one national 527 that had ACT in its name. I can remember which one it was at this point. They and a couple of others, what they opted to do within the 30 and 60 D. American Coming Together, that's what it is, American Coming Together. What they opted to do, American Coming Together, is in the last 60 days before the general election, they retreated from significantly doing television type of advertising and went into what I would call more traditional grassroots type of activity, door-to-door activity, web-based activity, get-out-the-vote type of stuff. And so we did find in this last election some groups that decided that what they wanted to do was in that last 60-day period was to not put their dollars into sort of, you know, media work, but instead to do this more grassroots activity. Whether that constitutes an effort to try to escape disclosure or represented an effort by America Coming Together to want to channel their resources for strategic reasons, one can have a debate on that. So that's at least one that I can think of, and there's probably others out there.
Representative Lesh, can you follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. The second question is a little more nebulous. It seems to me that since 1976, this whole process has been kind of like trying to catch a greased pig, or Professor Schultz, you characterize it like squeezing a water balloon. It goes somewhere else, because the Supreme Court has said money is speech for the most part, and whether it's soft money, whether it's a party, or independent expenditure, or a 527, the money is going to go somewhere else, no matter how much regulation we make, until the U.S. Supreme Court changes their decision on that. It seems to a certain extent, like I said, an exercise in futility. So can you explain why, when we're talking about this, if there's a magic bullet or something that we're missing about how we could modify this, short of complete and open disclosure, that would actually... get to the root of this entire problem.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, sort of a couple corrections. One of the things that the Supreme Court has never said, either in Buckley or in McConnell, the court has never said with five votes, money is speech. It has said that money has speech-like qualities, and in some situations it implicates the First Amendment, but it has never said money is speech. And the reason why that's important to note is that because money is not equivocated with speech, it opens up situations where you can have disclosure requirements, you can have contribution limits, and potentially, although the court, with the exception of one case, has not allowed for expenditure limits. And so I just want to correct that for anybody who wants to sort of think that the court has said money is speech. So far as I know, my George Washington in my back pocket is not equivalent to speech. But the second point is that in terms of we can't control all the money, therefore we throw up our hands in exasperation and say we shouldn't do anything. Well, clearly transparency and disclosure is one element in terms of a good campaign finance regulatory system. That disclosure, I think, becomes essential, and I would hope that everybody here at least agrees on that much in terms of the more disclosure, that's better. But second, not all of us are as pessimistic as some in terms of the inability to sort of get a grasp on money in politics. That, for example, Minnesota has done a remarkable job in terms of its what I call its hard money contribution system for the last 10 to 20 years. The contributions directly to candidates tied into the voluntary public financing system. That has been an outstanding, in fact, one of the best systems in the country in terms of achieving that. The weakness in our current system is in terms of the unlimited money that can go to parties and caucuses. Can we nail that down? Yes. Does that mean we still have some areas where money might still affect? Yes. But in the same way that I don't think any legislation can solve all the problems of the world, the more that we can try to eliminate or control the impact of money upon the political process, the better it is. And clearly regulation is there. And second, in terms of contribution limits, voluntary expenditure limits tied into public financing. Anecdotally, I should just say, and this is not meant to sort of hype something, but about 2 years ago, I had a book that came out on campaign finance reform across different states. And what the goal was is to try to find out, based upon what different states are doing, what works and what doesn't work. It's 13 case studies. I had 13 different people write it in terms of different chapters. And one of the things that we could actually show that is in Minnesota, Minnesota's hard money system, you know, the contribution limits and the voluntary public financing did more in terms of encouraging more competitive races and eliminating or at least narrowing the differences between challengers and incumbents in terms of fundraising. And so in many ways, the point that I'm getting at is that we can do a lot of good with contribution limits and voluntary expenditure limits, so we shouldn't ignore that in the process.
Thank you. Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question that I was going to ask has already been answered, but I would like to ask a question of Professor Schultz based on what he just said. It occurred to me that in the current governor's budget proposal, the political contribution refund program is eliminated. If that should prevail, what do you think the effect would be on politics in Minnesota?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, should they zero out or eliminate the public subsidy program for the state of Minnesota in terms of the $50 rebate program, it would have a major disastrous effect upon campaigns in the state, because at this point, a couple of things occur. One of the things that's tied into that rebate is both limits on how much certain types of entities can be contributed to candidates for state races, such as money from PACs, lobbyists, and so forth. And second, it imposes, as a condition of participating in that rebate program, it imposes contribution, or rather expenditure limits upon candidates. Both of those are very worthy things to occur in terms of trying to place limits upon some special interest giving money. Two, it's important in terms of limiting overall expenditures to try to make it more affordable for people to run. And then third, what's wonderful when under the Minnesota rebate program, it also encourages and gives incentives for more smaller donors to give money. And so that there are lots of important virtues for that to occur. And then I think I'll stop at that thing. There's lots of important virtues, and I think it would be a mistake to eliminate that system. That is not contrary to what some people say. It is not welfare for people running for office. The only system in the country, the only state system in the country that's been able to narrow the gap between incumbents and challengers in terms of how much money they raise and spend, the only system in the country that has been able to improve more competitiveness between the two parties, has been Minnesota, and we can tie that into the rebate program.
Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I was going to ask Representative De La Forest's question, and then I was going to ask the silver bullet question from Representative Lesch, and they seem to be getting answered, but it's, I think it's interesting because in 06, if you really project out, with the House being so close, the Senate being so close, a U.S. Senate rate race. 527s have a long line on their way to Minnesota, I think, already, starting today. And we all know that they focus on races like the Otto Dean race, the Boudreaux Fritz race. Well, you can kind of predict exactly where they go. And I'm a win-lose-win-win-win. So, I mean, I've been there on both sides of that back when it was soft money, and now it's the 527s. So I think when we talk about whether we're pessimistic or optimistic, it's hard to know because the money is there, and is there a way to get rid of it? In your research, you mentioned you've done this, written a book, Professor Schultz. A couple things, I guess I have a two-part question. One is we often try to estimate some of these big races like, and I say Representative Dean because, of course, he won, and Representative Otto, former representative, we estimate how much was really spent on those, $100,000, $150,000. Have you done any estimates on some of these high-profile legislative races and related to 527s? And what would be the best reform you've seen in another state that could be implemented here?
Okay.
Professor Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in terms of the first question that you asked, in terms of how much money have 527s spent, I'm assuming per race. Now, I'm assuming you're referencing state races at this point. I'll have to confess and say I don't have good information on it at this point because we're really looking at, I think, the 04 cycle as really sort of the first election cycle where this really rises as a phenomenon. And so as the reporting data comes in, I think now and over the next few weeks with campaign practices, we'll be in a better position to try to make some judgments on that. And so, you know, the simple answer is it's too soon to tell. But we do know from just in general in the past, if I can abstract to it, that in special elections for a particular Senate seat or a House race or in sort of critical swing races, when you add up all the dollars in terms of how much groups are spending, I think we've seen some special elections total out in the state for state races over $200,000, $250,000. And so they can be very costly in terms of what they might actually occur. Now, in terms of the second question, I think you were coming back and asking, again, what are other states doing in terms of 527s again also. Again, the answer is the same thing as before. It's too soon to tell. I mean, a lot of states are grappling with the 527 phenomenon in the same way we are. There are some states that, for example, I think that are in far worse shape than we are in terms of the fact, for example, like Texas, which does not have very good disclosure laws, and so that 527s that would operate within the state of Texas would not have the same registration requirements that Minnesota would have, and would not have much in terms of disclosure laws, and so they could very well have an enormous impact, and we wouldn't know simply because they're not being tracked. At least in Minnesota, right now, we have post-election for 527s that try to affect the race, we do have some disclosure that we're going to find, that we're going to have in place. Again, what I was sort of recommending before, I think, for a couple of representatives, is that if we want to track the 527s, we could impose more pre-election, as they affect state races, we could impose more pre-election disclosure requirements, and we could require more post-election disclosure requirements also. But clearly, I think for most of our concern, the pre-election is what we really want to have in hand, because we really want to see, while the election is going, who's spending what.
I have five names remaining, and we have about 6 minutes left, so if you could ask short questions and short answers, that would be wonderful, because we will adjourn at 2:15. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question for either or both gentlemen. A hypothetical for you. I just want to get a sense of where state regulation could possibly come into play. Let's say it's Halloween before Election Day, clearly 30 days within the 30-day period. It's Halloween, and the Frostbite Falls Fund decides to do a literature drop. No media, just a literature drop with its own volunteers or paid people. And instead of promoting the election of a particular candidate for state races only, the Frostbite Falls Fund hands out literature at doors that says, promote pro-widget candidates. Under that scenario, would there be an impediment either from the standpoint of preemption, or would there be a constitutional impediment somehow to the state regulating disclosure, if you understand the question?
Professor Flegel.
That's an interesting question, which will take considerably longer than 5 minutes to address. But a very brief response might be
that to the extent that the activity is designed around or seeks out a loophole, it may well be calculated to achieve that loophole. Your hypothetical is very carefully designed to try and avert the characteristic of direct election activities or electioneering communications. To the extent that it is not express advocacy for the election or defeat of a specific candidate, it may fall outside of the controls that would be imposed under the Federal Election Commission. The easiest answer is that it wouldn't meet automatically that litmus test. But to the extent that one could readily understand and appreciate what a pro-widget candidate was so that it would be readily capable of identifying whether that's for this person or against that person, then it would trespass the admonition about not having a direct impact on election activities, because it would advocate for the election or defeat of a specific identifiable candidate.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, though, from the state regulatory standpoint, not the FEC, could the state jump in there somehow or not?
How much is being spent?
I'm sorry. Oh, how much is being spent? I hadn't thought about that. Would that be the determining?
I think the determining factor, briefly, would be, yes, the level of activity. Our focus and the way that we've managed to keep our system clearly within the constitutional confines of the state and federal constitutions is by focusing on contribution activities rather than on expenditure activities. It may fall outside the scope of state regulatory schemes if it was not a direct contribution.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll spare you any more Forrest Natasha comparisons, and but just thank you for being here. And also, just from a standpoint of a candidate, I can tell you that dealing with the Disclosure Board has been very helpful, very common sense. I think common sense and openness are, you know, what I found as a candidate, and I thought it was a very good process and very good to deal with. But basically, there's three things that you deal with: where the money comes from, where the money goes, and to those of us who accept limits, there's a cap. And I think all three of those things make for very open and competitive elections. And from a candidate standpoint, I think it's really troublesome that we see that eroding with 527. Just from a candidate standpoint, in just looking at affecting races, what limitations are there on me or perhaps on my spouse if we were to contribute to a 527 that might affect my race or others that would be outside of the transparency and openness that I think we all like and we want to protect and strengthen if we can?
Professor Flegel?
Representative Dean, that's a difficult question to address. If we assume that everyone is proceeding both in their candidacy and the 527 is proceeding with the objective of conforming its conduct to Minnesota law, we get into a question about earmarking. And if I'm a candidate and I want to give to a 527 because it's going to support me indirectly, once my check gets into their hands, I would violate other laws if it's earmarked, give this back to me. Assuming, therefore, that a 527 sought to comply with the law, it would owe no obligation to give funds back to me. And under those circumstances, a candidate or their spouse could contribute to a 527 without those kinds of concerns. That they have somehow violated other reporting or regulatory schemes, unless there was at the outset an intent to defeat those schemes through illegal earmarking of contributions. In terms of the where the money comes from, where it goes, and the limits on caps, those are all objectives of the Minnesota system, and it is a successful one in that the balance that we've been able to achieve with our constitutional mandates and rights is by in treating individual candidates to voluntarily limit their activities based on the public subsidy and those kinds of funds. So as a whole, I think the Minnesota system works effectively to achieve the objectives that this body has put forth in promoting openness in government, but I think simply needs to remain vigilant against the potential for 527s to defeat those very laudable objectives.
Last question, Representative Hilty. We have about 30 seconds left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This probably should be addressed to Professor Flegel. Excuse me. I'm just trying to kind of review the conversation and get straight in my mind. It occurred to me to ask about 527s and their ability to make contributions to political units or candidates. Is there any distinction between making a contribution, say, to a political party that's clearly intended just to support their campaign activities, or like, would it be legal for a 527 to contribute to a political party to pay the rent for headquarters or to pay for staff under some circumstances?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hilty, in the materials that I outlined, the percentages of expenditures by 527s are assessed, and they include various kinds of direct activities, as well as the transfer of funds to various agencies, professional services, contributions to non-federal candidates, administrative costs, and the like. They can spend their money pretty much any way they want. The issue then becomes whether the funds, once they're received, fall subject to a state regulatory scheme, and Minnesota does seek to assure that the proprieties are observed in terms of how those funds are spent, or at a minimum to exact a level of disclosure so that the public can be aware of that activity.
And just very briefly, Mr. Chair, Professor Flegel, would that require their being registered in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, in the event that more than $100 is given, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you to both professors as well as Gene Olson for being here today. This has been very educational, and some of us may follow up with you in the future privately.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're adjourned.